There's a new lens through which particular academics and others are seeing reality, particularly as it relates to gender or sexual identity. And that is a theory called social constructionism.
On the feature today, we dig into what's behind the discussion on gender identity in our society. In the news, a supposed cost-benefit analysis of euthanasia and some reaction to it. ARPA launching a video series on the benefits of palliative care. PEI is now in the abortion business, and the discussion about regulating gender pronouns comes to the conservative leadership race.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
There's a new study out that purports to put a dollar figure on the cost savings inherent in euthanasia. The report, authored by Aaron Trachtenberg at the University of Calgary, says doctor-assisted death could reduce healthcare spending across the country by between about $35 million and $137 million a year. Trachtenberg told the CBC the numbers reflect a reduction in spending in the healthcare system. The report has raised serious concerns, though. Donna Trimble is very worried about this. You've heard her on the program before in her role with Parents for Choice in Education in Alberta. But she's also suffering from stage 2 breast cancer.
One of the best pieces of advice I got when I was first diagnosed was from a very good friend in Quebec. And he said to me, you know, Donna, surrender to the process. Give yourself up to the hands of your doctors and trust them. But when you see studies like this, suddenly that idea of being able to surrender yourself to the care of your doctor isn't so simple anymore, because you have to ask yourself, what is his priority, her priority? Are these financial matters behind closed doors something that they consider in their advice that they give to me? I've met many people since I was diagnosed that had stage 3 cancer, stage 4 cancer, that are still living today. Would they get the same care 2, 3, 4 years down the line after euthanasia or doctor-assisted suicide has become habitual? And these types of studies about the cost savings become more relevant behind the scenes.
Trimble has also written to the CBC to complain about the way Trachtenberg's report is being covered.
There's plenty of information out there about how, you know, doctor-assisted suicide is a slippery slope, where it's led to in places in Europe where it is taking place. And we don't see enough of that in the media.
In related news, ARPA has launched a video series on the need for better palliative care in Canada. Grassroots manager Colin Postma says the series is designed to counter the narrative that people with terminal illnesses have two choices, either a slow, painful death or a supposedly more humane option of medical assistance in dying.
That narrative is wrong on a number of fronts, and we've decided to launch a project called Ending Suffering, the Palliative Care Alternative. We've already released 2 parts of what we hope to be a 12-part series, where we interview Canadians across the country about their experiences with things like terminal disease, disability, pain, and then their experience with palliative care. A new edition is released each Thursday, usually on our Facebook page first, and then it'll be available on the website as well right after that.
Postma says the long-term plan is to turn those 12 videos into a feature-length documentary suitable for screening to ARPA chapters, church groups, and others. Prince Edward Island has opened an abortion clinic. Women of the island used to have to go to Moncton or Halifax for the procedure, but a clinic is now open in Charlottetown, the fulfillment of a promise made by Premier Wade McLaughlin in an election campaign last year. Mike Schutten with We Need a Law says this really doesn't make any sense.
There's no reason why a medically unnecessary procedure has to be available on the island when we have people continuing to transfer to hospitals either in New Brunswick or Nova Scotia for much more serious things, heart issues, cancer treatments, etc. We see no move for those services to be provided on the island, but dare not we have an island, a province of a population of 130,000 where women cannot easily access a facility to kill their preborn child.
Speaking of We Need a Law, they were set up at the Vancouver Convention Center this past weekend for Missions Fest. That's billed as the largest explicitly Christian trade show in Canada. Cassie Knecht helped to put the display together. She says the response was encouraging.
For most of these people, they've never heard of us and they don't know how to get involved in politics. It seems like kind of a foreign concept and something that other people do. But once they hear what we do and the tools that we can give, then they're a lot more willing to actually engage with their MPs and with fellow Canadians as well.
And finally, the discussion about gender pronouns has hit the federal conservative leadership race. 2 candidates for the leadership, Brad Trost and Pierre Lemieux, have committed that if they win the leadership and form government, they'll repeal Bill C-16. That's the one that entrenches the notions of gender identity and gender expression as prohibited grounds for discrimination under the Criminal Code of the Human Rights Act. Lemieux says fundamentally, the law would tell Canadians what pronouns they have to use in dealing with gender issues.
When bills like this pass, you will be obligated to use these pronouns. And that's why I say free speech, not forced speech. If a Canadian chooses to use these new invented pronouns, that's their choice. But they should not be forced into doing so.
Prost, who also issued a press release on this, calls Bill C-16, quote, a bad law, plain and simple. Back with more after this.
Tomorrow, ARPA will appear in court to challenge the Ontario government's censorship of abortion statistics. By denying access to abortion data, the Ontario government is preventing pro-lifers from doing important work. Please pray for ARPA's legal team, particularly for John Sikkema, as he argues a good portion of the case. Pray for a sense of calm and for clarity in speech. Pray for the judge who will be hearing the case, and ultimately that God's will be done. And pray for justice for the unborn. Thanks for your ongoing support.
And we're back on the program. Recently, ARPA applied to appear before a committee at Hamilton City Hall. The city of Hamilton is apparently trying to develop some municipal policies on how to deal with transgenderism. This goes to use of civic bathrooms, those kinds of things. And we're still waiting to hear whether or not ARPA will be accepted to appear before that committee. But if we do, it'll be likely Andre Schutten that makes the presentation. And I've got Andre on the line with me from Ottawa. Hi, Andre.
Hey, Al.
What is underlying this? I mean, first we've got, you know, the federal bill that talks about banning any discrimination based on gender identity. Then we've got Jordan Peterson getting in trouble at the University of Toronto because he refuses to sort of live with this new reality in terms of language. What's underlying all this?
The background is that there's a new theory, a new lens through which particular academics and others, activists and so on, are seeing reality, and particularly as it relates to gender or sexual identity. And that is a theory called social constructionism. So social constructionism sees all of reality, or most parts of reality, as merely being ideas that we've created in order to live our life. And usually they see it through a lens of oppressor and oppressed. So the creation of categories by society in order to keep on oppressing others, or in order to be able to remain in a hierarchical society. So the big one when it comes to social constructs today is the idea that male or female, those two categories are merely social constructs. They're merely ideas that society has created amongst themselves in order to maintain a system or hierarchy of oppressor and oppressed. So obviously the allegation would be that the idea that there are males and that there are females is this idea of patriarchy for them to oppress women. That's kind of the lens through which most of our leading politicians, when it comes to the advancement of the transgender agenda today, sees the world.
This isn't new. I mean, the whole social construct idea has its roots in sort of literary criticism from 100 years ago. There are some legitimate social constructs. I mean, we can think of some, but is gender one of them? Give me some examples of what would be legitimate social constructs and how you would apply this in this gender context.
I'll give you two examples of legitimate social constructs. So one would be money. When we have a $20 bill in our hand, there's nothing intrinsically valuable about that piece of paper in our hand that says that this little piece of paper is actually worth $20. But we've created a system in which we say, no, that little piece of paper in your hand, it actually is worth $20. But of course, if our society tomorrow agreed that we're going to actually switch to the gold standard, we're going to use gold coins instead of paper, suddenly that $20 bill is no longer worth $20. It's only just a piece of paper and it's worth maybe a couple of cents. That would be an example of a social construct. When it comes to gender, it gets a little bit more tricky because there are certain things about gender that are social constructs. A very obvious one for us today would be that pink is a girl's color. That's true in our Western culture from the last number of decades, perhaps, that generally speaking, pink is more a girl's color and blue is more a boy's color. But that's a social construct. We've made that up ourselves. But the problem with today's assault on the binary nature of humanity, and what I mean by binary nature is there's two and only two categories of humanity, male or female, the assault today on that idea, they've extrapolated the idea that there's some social constructs around gender, and they said actually all of gender is socially constructed. And so we actually should not be binding ourselves to these categories anymore. We should eliminate the categories altogether.
There's a whole raft of language associated with this, cisgender and different pronouns and stuff.
So cisgender is a new word that has been created that refers to those who do fit themselves neatly into one of these two categories, either male or female. There's the language of multiple pronouns now. So again, in the English language, there's two types of pronouns, right? Male or female. The problem is that with the advance of multiple other genders, we now have public policy that's requiring or at least putting pressure on individuals to use third, fourth, 32nd, 51st type of genders. New York City has passed an ordinance that businesses can be fined up to $250,000 if they refuse to use the gender pronoun of an individual's choice, and they've listed up to 31 different types of pronouns. That becomes completely, totally unworkable.
Have we lost the sense of normativity? Post-truth was the word of the year for 2016, and I'm seeing that this is another sort of manifestation of that.
I think that's accurate in certain respects. The irony in my mind is that many of the people that use that label, that throw it around, they're often the ones guilty of what they're accusing the other side of. I mean, our biological reality is a reality. It's measurable. It's scientific. It's real. And we know as Christians that that's exactly the way God designed it. We're told that in Scripture, male and female, He created them. So it's very obvious to us. And so this modern phenomenon, I'm not sure how long it can last. I mean, the truth can go on forever. Falsehood needs a lot of help. And that's, I guess, why we're particularly concerned about the force of law upholding this kind of view, this social constructionist kind of view, because it only makes the falsehood last longer. If it were left on its own, I think it would die out pretty quick.
So, assuming we get the go-ahead to appear before that committee at Hamilton City Council, you're not going to have, you know, a lot of time to present there. The essence of the message you'll be bringing there is what?
Well, there's two different angles that could be taken. One is to explore this a little bit, this whole idea of social constructionism, and try to show City Council that this new approach to transgenderism is based on an assumption that there's a particular lens through which we need to see the world, and that is this social constructionist lens. But it's only a theory. It's a theory of a few academics in their white towers dreaming up a way through which we're going to see the world. There are many other theories through which to see the world, and one of the biggest ones and one of the best one, is a Judeo-Christian worldview, a worldview that sees the world really, truly as it is. And that's the basis through which we should be building our laws and our policies. The sad, unfortunate reality is that many of the bureaucrats have accepted as fact this social constructionist view of things. So I would love to be able to explore that a little bit with the City of Hamilton, and then also to explore the whole legal question of reasonable accommodation and balancing of rights. So the City of Hamilton is in charge of all kinds of municipal buildings. Those include swimming pools, high school buildings that are often rented out in the summer for use of gyms and so on and so forth. There's a surprising number of bathrooms, washrooms, change rooms, shower rooms, etc., that are under the control of the City of Hamilton. This policy that they're considering is going to allow, if it's approved, it's going to allow any individual for any reason to self-identify as any of the two sexes and be able to have access to any change room, washroom, shower. That's problematic. There's no balancing of rights there. There's no reasonable accommodation going on there. Reasonable accommodation would say transgender individual, somebody struggling with their gender identity, let's create a safe third space where they have the privacy to be able to change or to use the washroom or to take a shower as needed. That might be a reasonable accommodation. But to say 50% of the population, all females, regardless of age, regardless of maturity, must give up their right to reasonable privacy from the eyes of biological males, whether or not they identify as female or male, that to me is totally unreasonable. It's not accommodating on behalf of the transgender community at all. I think that currently our Ontario Human Rights Code actually allows for the City of Hamilton to say, no, we're not going to allow biological males access to female restrooms. There's actually an exception built into the code to allow that. Of course, the tribunal and the commission aren't drawing too much attention to that because it doesn't fit within their social constructionist view of things.
Andre, we're out of time. Thanks very much.
No problem. Thanks very much for hearing me.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by going to our homepage, www.lighthousenews.ca, and clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the page. Or you can send us an email, lighthousenews@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.